Distributing the future, beta broadcast number one.
The future is going to be bigger than the past. There's going to be more happening. Connected systems, connected devices, connected data. What can we do in that world that will be interesting, powerful, and useful?
Changing the world through capturing the knowledge of innovators.
The future is here. It's just not evenly distributed yet.
Welcome to Distributing the Future from O'Reilly Media. I'm Daniel Steinberg, and each week we bring you the technology and the people behind what you use now and what you'll use next. In the next half hour, Phil Tirone of Make Magazine says you may not want to upgrade your PSP. Nat Torkington previews the upcoming debut of a new open source conference to be held in Amsterdam in mid-October. David Smith and Doc Searle discuss issues of identity with Andy Oram. Chris Adamson tells you how to get started with the game, the exercise, the cult, Dance Dance Revolution, and our featured FooCast is Richard Giles' Gadget Show interview with John Battelle. We begin with David Pogue, author of Mac OS X, The Missing Manual, Tiger Edition. David has some tips and tricks on Spotlight, the new search engine built into Mac OS X Tiger.
Get over this idea that it's just for finding long-lost files that you don't know where they are. What I mean is, use it as a way to open files and programs and disks and look up things in your calendar and address book and to-do list that you know perfectly well where they are, but it's just faster to get to them from the keyboard. The Spotlight menu has room for only 20 hits. The program attempts to intelligently divide up those 20 precious slots among applications, PDF files, images, documents, and so on. But by turning off the categories that you rarely need to search, you force Spotlight to give more of those 20 precious slots to the things you do need to search, like documents and applications, in my case. Command up arrow and command down arrow jump you to the first match in each category, PDFs, applications, documents, or whatever. And then from there, you can use the arrow key to walk down to the item you want and press spacebar or enter to open it up. In the box, you can type the word kind and then a colon, and with no spaces, type something like application, contacts, folders, email, event, image, movie, music, audio, PDF, and that will restrict the search to that kind of document. In the same way, you can restrict your search by chronology. You can type date colon yesterday or date colon next year to find only things that have been opened or refer to those dates. And by the way, if you type, you know, date colon tomorrow, that's primarily intended for looking up upcoming iCal events. You could actually find all PDFs you've opened today by typing date colon today space kind colon PDF.
David Pogue. You can find his complete podcast on Spotlight, along with Poguecasts on Automator and Dashboard at MacDevCenter.com. You can also find these and more information about his latest book, Mac OS X, The Missing Manual Tiger Edition, at MissingManuals.com. You'll find all the links from Distributing the Future in our show notes. Should we produce an enhanced podcast for folks listening via iTunes? Send email to future@O'Reilly.com. Thousands of developers descended on Portland, Oregon in August for OSCON, O'Reilly's open source conference. Nat Torkington joins us via Skype to talk about a new conference, EuroOSCON, coming up October 17th to 20th in Amsterdam. Nat explains that EuroOSCON is a new conference with a flavor all its own that also takes advantage of the long heritage of OSCON.
We've had a wildly successful conference in the U.S. for a long time. We've been doing OSCON in San Diego, Monterey, and now in Portland. And we've got 2,500 people who love the mix of deep technology and really interesting hackers that we can bring to the table. And so we thought there's a whole lot of really interesting technology and really deep hackers that are working in Europe. Why don't we try doing a conference over there? We've got one day of tutorials and 3 days of sessions planned at a very nice hotel in Amsterdam. We're looking to bring together the interesting people and the interesting projects.
You kick off the conference as you traditionally do with an interesting night featuring Larry Wall and Damian Conway.
They've become staples at the American OSCON. Larry's best known as the father of Perl, or if you're not a Perl programmer, possibly as the father of the RN newsreader, or the patch program if you're an open source developer. And so he's brings a lot of open source cred to the table, but he's also not just talking about open source and not just talking about Perl, but he generally tends to speak to the human elements of of what we do. And so it's always thought-provoking and philosophical in a way that probably you don't get at other conferences. Damien's known as the mad genius of Perl, the crazy man in the basement who can make Perl speak Latin, who can make it speak Klingon, who can bring us Perl 6 before Perl 6 is here, and possibly even bring us Perl 7 before Perl 6 is here. He's just doing amazing stuff in Perl, and he's always an entertaining speaker.
So you think, sort of think of Perl as sort of the foundations of OSCON, sort of where it all started, and yet as I look over the program here, you're reaching into the future with people like David speaking on Ruby and Rails.
We grew out of the Perl conference, the very first conferences that O'Reilly did were the Perl conferences. But open source is much more than Perl. We have strong Python representation. We have David Hindemeyer Hansen talking about Ruby on Rails, giving a tutorial and a keynote on that. Looked like everything was getting staid and boring, and then along came Rails in the web development world. It blew it out of the water. We've got Apache, we've got MySQL, we've got Postgres. Pretty much you name an open source technology, and we have it there. There's a Linux track that's really sort of Linux operating systems, other operating systems and applications. So we cover things like the FreeBSD release methodology, which is a really interesting topic for anybody who's looking to see how a huge open source project manages its releases.
You know, some folks who haven't been to an O'Reilly open source conference before might be a little surprised to see Microsoft on the program.
I used to believe that shared source wasn't open source, that there was a reason the name was different. And there is a reason the name is different, but it's not because Microsoft don't intend to use open source or create open source where they can. Shared source is an umbrella term for the whole initiative within Microsoft to release software source code. And O'Reilly philosophy says we don't judge them to be bad for putting a restrictive license on it. It's their software. They can choose whatever license they wish to use. The market will decide whether the software lives or dies. The core source code to their business, like the Windows source code, isn't open sourced. The source code is available, but it's not very open. However, there are projects, for instance, the Windows XML-based installer, which have a huge community-based building around them and which are truly open source in the open source sense of it being a GPL-like license or a BSD-like license or an Apache-style license. I think Microsoft are really on the ball about releasing software as open source, and we're going to see a lot more of it from them. Microsoft should learn from what the open source community has done, and the open source community should learn that some things Microsoft do is not evil. Jason Mattuso is the head of the Shared Source Initiative at Microsoft, and so he's going to be keynoting at EuroOSCon to talk about what they're doing and how it ties into open source. And in case anybody thinks that we've sold out by inviting the devil to the table or anything like that, the OSCon keynotes on Tuesday feature people like Alan Cox, who's pretty much well-known as one of the main developers of the Linux kernel. And he'll be there to give us his take on open source as well. So there's certainly no treachery on our part inviting Microsoft. We believe there should be a good discussion to be had here.
So much of O'Reilly conferences happen both inside and outside of sessions. What kind of a field do you expect to see here at EuroOSCon?
Oh, the hallway track is always the best attended. There's always great people to run into. One of the things we pride ourselves on doing is bringing the leading people from different parts of open source together into the one room and the one building so that you can meet them and talk to them. And so you get amazing discussions and initiatives that are created as a result of this. There's something to be said for having the head of Ruby on Rails and the head of Perl and a major developer behind Apache all at the same table. If you have a problem that you're trying to work your way through with open source, if you're looking to get the best experiences of people who are out there on the cutting edge adopting open source, then there's no better place to be. We've also got some really interesting stuff in there on emerging technologies. We have not just the straight up open source that everybody's familiar with, MySQL and Apache and Python, for instance. We've tried to get in some content that's a little more on the interesting side. For example, we have Nikolai Nyholm talking about his work hacking the Linksys Wi-Fi routers to add in extra features that make them competitive with very high-end Cisco boxes. We have somebody talking about FPGA hacking. So it's hardware, creating hardware using open source tools and, in essence, creating open source hardware. So we try to get beyond the obvious open source candidates and give you a sign of some of the things that are coming down the hallway, as well as the stuff that you need to know about, you know, how to migrate to an open source database, for example, or getting started with Subversion, or what's new in Firefox. These are things that that we have, but we also try to provide something that looks further down the road.
Nat Torkington, EuroOSCON co-chair, contributes to radar.oreilly.com. On his radar this week, EuroOSCON, which runs October 17th to 20th in Amsterdam. For more information and to register, visit conferences.oreilly.com. This is Distributing the Future. There's a classic cartoon that on the internet, no one knows your dog. Identity remains a challenge. How do you communicate who you are in a way that can be trusted, secure, and in which you decide what parts of your identity get communicated to others? At the most recent OSCON in Portland, O'Reilly editor Andy Oram spoke with Passel developer David Smith and others about identity. The website at passel.org describes Passel as a lightweight, user-centric identity system that enables people to manage their own online identity. Passel's built on the idea that identity is composed of equal parts social norms and third-party verified information. Doc Searles, co-author of the ClueTrain Manifesto and senior editor for the Linux Journal, is a Passel advisor, and he starts us off responding to a question on the importance of identity.
Andre Durand, just before he started Ping, called me up one day and he said, identity is the whole deal. Identity is the problem. The net is a collection of services. We're missing an identity service. We need to fix the identity problem somehow. He said, there are essentially three, what he called them at the time, tiers of identity. The first tier is one that people pay very little attention to, which is the collection of selves that organize them, that organize behind the first person singular pronoun, I, right? You know, what we call sanity is our ability to organize all of the different selves we are behind this one singular thing. Tier two, he said, was assigned identity, which is the kind of identity that's given to us by organizations, from the library that gives us a library card to the driver's the DMV to the Social Security Administration to Costco. All of these things are silos that surround somebody's CRM, customer relationship management system, essentially. And all of them are lame in to the degree that they really appreciate almost nothing about ourselves other than credit history, a small, relatively flat schema of some sort. That's, you know, name, address, and a few other things, and that's about it. And then there's a third level he called market identity, which is where, say, Volvo knows your zip code and your name and address, but they don't know anything else about you other than, say, your zip code, and they think, well, you live in an upscale zip code, you might buy a Volvo, so here's a flyer, right? And one of the things he said is if there's a real relationship between Tier 1 and Tier 2, Tier 3 disappears, because you don't need this guesswork anymore, mostly because the user is in charge of their identity. Chris Locke galvanized what we were doing with ClueTrain. It was just a conversation up to the point that he sent this little GIF out to everybody that said, we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We are human beings, and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it. And it spoke in the voice of the marketplace to the Tier 2 guys, essentially, you know, and the Tier 3 guys, saying, the power relationship has changed because of the net. We're in charge now. And what ClueTrain was about, essentially, was the demand side having power in the marketplace more than ever before because it was a networked marketplace. When Andre said what identity, a real identity service does for Tier 1 is that it gives full power to the customer, that spoke to me in a huge way. I thought, that's it. And he totally hooked me on the identity notion at that point. I said, this is a missing piece. Now, I went to a place where nobody's addressing it exactly right now, to some limited degree, I think, but a significant one because we're talking about it. The identity commons people are talking about this. My vision of what ought to be happening, the use case, I imagine, in the marketplace for identity, for the use of Tier 1 identity, is that as a customer, not just as a consumer, I can present myself in a selective way to a marketplace and have providers in that marketplace come outside of their silos, see the advantage of being outside their silos, and compete for my business or leverage the relationship with me they already have. Car rental agencies all have identical CRMs. They're all copying each other. They're like a controlled study. You walk into the you know, you get off the airplane, you go to the luggage carousel, you come off. There's Hertz, Avis, Budget, Thrifty, and so forth on down the line. All of them are competing with each other to give you the lousiest maps and to, you know, hook you into their scams of involving buying gas and insurance and the rest of it. Right now, it's an all-silo system. You kind of go like a bee from one flower to another, from one silo to another, looking for some kind of a deal. What I'd like to do is say, hey, marketplace, I'm in Denver. I want to rent a four-wheel drive vehicle because I'm going into the mountains that'll seat at least four. I'm going to the mountains. I'm going to do some skiing. It's January, something like that. I have relationships with Hertz and Budget, and you know, that's basically it. Who's gonna get me the car, right? And then I can compare and contrast. That is, in the long run, that's going to be better for the market. It'll be better for any of those individuals, and it'll be better for me. And few of us have actually imagined where that goes. I mean, Andre was the first one I talked to who did, and that's sort of the end state that I'm looking for.
Well, this gets back again, I think, to something that's missing from the internet, and that is, you know, with everything's anonymous, because the internet was kind of designed to be that way from the get-go. There wasn't really the idea of identity. And that's one of the reasons why there's so much work going on in the identity space right now, because we don't have the cues, the visual and biometric and otherwise, about people that we would otherwise have. And that's, you know, both inhibited society, like we talked about before, because people can just act like morons on the internet because no one knows who they are. But it also makes it difficult for us to find like-minded people or you know, make the sort of decisions and interactions that we have in everyday life, because there's no cues. So that's one of the things that we certainly hope to enable with Passel, and I think Tier 1 identity starts to enable you to say things about yourself in such a way that you can prove it, if you will, to other parties.
David Smith of Ping Identity and Doc Searle, senior editor of the Linux Journal, in conversation with O'Reilly editor Andy Oram. The right to own and manage your own identity seems to be as obvious as the right to modify and hack the gadgets that you've paid for. Make Magazine Associate Editor Phil Terone joins us for the segment of Distributing the Future called Void Your Warranty. Often Phil will tell you about fun ways to take a device you own and make it do more of what you want it to. This week, Phil tells you that sometimes upgrading to the latest version removes functionality that you've come to like and depend on. We reach Phil via Skype.
For folks who have PlayStation Portables, it's a great, stunning device. Sony released these. They have beautiful screens. They have Wi-Fi. They're really, really great devices. Now, unfortunately, as Sony's released new updates to the firmware, they're disabling things. And what they're disabling is the ability to run your own games and your own software and all the things that really make computers fun. If you want to play a chess game, you really can't buy any chess games from Sony, and so someone made their own chess game. Now, the problem is Sony doesn't like this. They want you to only buy their games on these little UMDs. They're like little tiny DVDs, and that's great. But you know, they're never going to release the titles that some of us want. They also won't make emulators to play old like Commodore 64 games. And so this is something that's pretty great for a lot of us. And to be you know, completely accurate on what Sony's been releasing, is the games haven't been that great that they've been releasing, and there's not a lot of them. So I really think that the people that have been doing the PlayStation portable hacking and game development and homebrew development have really been keeping this platform alive. And so this week, Sony's releasing PlayStation Portable 2 update, and basically the update adds a couple of things. They're niceties. They're not anything overwhelmingly amazing. And what they've added is the ability to have a browser. Now, you can already make your own browser using a game called Wipeout Pure. And if you search the Make Magazine site, we have a little how-to on there on how to actually do that. And you can make your own browser, so you don't need their thing. You can also go and all the functionality they're adding with video and backgrounds and screens and all that, it's already kind of built in with the homebrew stuff. So there's nice things, but I'm suggesting to everyone that the best way to void your warranty this week is to actually not update, because you can continue to run these great things that Sony kind of doesn't want you to, and you know, continue to run these great homebrew applications. And we have a post about this on makezine.com, so check that that out and keep voiding your warranty. And if you're interested in running your own games, do search for PSP on Makezine, and you can see a how-to on how to get, download, and even make some of your own games for the PlayStation Portable.
Phil Chiron from Make Magazine with Void Your Warranty. As he mentioned, you can find more at makezine.com. Now, Phil talking to us each week about using devices in ways that the manufacturer didn't intend got us thinking. Some of these uses help you think about the devices in a totally different way. It's a floor wax, it's a dessert topping. Well, we started talking to people that we know in one context about things that they're passionate about that others might not know about them. For example, for OnJava.com and Java.net editor Chris Adamson, it was really easy. Each morning around 6 a.m., I see his instant message status switch from editing to DDR. Now, we've roomed together while traveling to meetings, so I know that this means he's paused to take out his Dance Dance Revolution mat and begin his half hour or so morning exercise. Is DDR a game, an exercise, or a cult? Chris shares his thoughts on it and tells you what you need to get started.
If you're a gamer, then you're probably already familiar with Dance Dance Revolution. Even if you're not, chances are you've seen this crazy dancing video game in the mainstream media. Those reports usually stress its health benefits, and that's a pity. Saying something's good for you is a great way to get people not interested in it. People forget that Citizen Kane and Do the Right Thing were entertaining before they were important. So let's look at how to get into DDR, at home, without the risk of embarrassing yourself at the food court arcade. That way, only your significant other will look at you funny. In this overview, you'll learn how to get set up with everything you need: the game, some songs, and dance pad controllers. There are basically two approaches to DDR at home: console video games and PCs. Let's start with the consoles. Game maker Konami has released several versions of DDR, or Dancing Stage as it's known in Europe, for the Xbox, PlayStation, and PlayStation 2. A GameCube version with Mario is coming, but early reviews of the Japanese version say the difficulty has been reduced to the point where it's only appropriate for very young children. The downside of the console approach is that you're limited to the songs that Konami puts in each version, and their taste leaves something to be desired. While gamers consider the arcade game DDR Extreme the ultimate version of DDR, almost none of its songs are on the North American PS2 home version. This is where open source comes to the rescue. A number of DDR clones are available on the net, and they play just like the real thing, while offering you more control over the game experience. Of these, the most popular is Stepmania, a SourceForge-hosted project at www.stepmania.com. Stepmania is available for Windows, Linux, and Mac OS X. However, Stepmania doesn't come with any music. What you need to play is both music and a set of metadata files that describe where and when you're supposed to step. Fortunately, these step files are fairly easy to find on the net. A number of sites host Stepmania files, which use an SM extension. More popular, though, are DWI files, a format defined by an earlier DDR emulator called Dance with Intensity. While DWI is gone, its files live on, and Stepmania can handle them just fine. More problematic is the music. Some sites host songs along with the files, but since this basically amounts to redistributing copyrighted content, such sites don't tend to last. To be good and legal about it, you could go get the DDR soundtracks on CD and rip your own music. Sites like www.animeaudio.com help here. So, you've got music. What do you dance on? There's a wide variety of home dance pad controllers available. Some come with USB connections, but the greatest variety of controllers and price points are for the PlayStation and PlayStation 2. Fortunately, there are plenty of third-party adapters to go from PlayStation to USB. Check the Stepmania page for a list of models known to work. There are three basic styles of dance pads, with corresponding price ranges. A basic foldable soft pad offers a way to try DDR without too big of an upfront investment. These controllers cost between $15 and $40. They're really only appropriate for beginners, though. That's because once you start dancing faster and more accurately, you'll find they miss some of your steps and tend to slip around on you. Next up is the zipper pad. This is a soft pad in which you insert large pieces of dense foam rubber and then zip it up around the side. These are a good choice for many players because they cushion your steps, yet they're sturdy and heavy enough not to move around on you. Zipper pads cost from $50 to $100 and are available in game stores and online. For the hardcore player, there's the metal pad. This duplicates the arcade hardware in the form of a very heavy metal enclosure with thick plastic buttons. This is the only pad you'd ever consider playing in your shoes, since stomping around in your Doc Martens would destroy soft pads pretty quickly. The downside here is the price. Metal pads run from $150 to $300. These pads are generally only available from specialty stores, online, or, of course, Fry's Electronics. Now, once you have game, songs, and pad, you're ready to go. It can take a few games to get acquainted with the concept, but it usually comes surprisingly quickly to most people. My advice is to move from beginner to light difficulty as soon as you can, and then on to standard. Single steps in isolation aren't really dancing, and hitting longer, faster runs are more fun. Also, some combinations of steps are easier if you're standing on a diagonal, or even sideways, looking at the screen over your shoulder. The more willing you are to move your body, the more fun you'll have. In most video games, the fun comes from accomplishing new things in the game world. What makes DDR special is that what you're accomplishing happens in the real world, even if your significant other does look at you funny.
On Java.com and Java.net editor Chris Adamson on DDR here on Distributing the Future. Of course, a big part of Distributing the Future is finding it. If you have a favorite science or technology podcast that you think we should listen to, send a note to future@O'Reilly.com. Point to a specific episode you think we might want to excerpt for this show. Here with his permission is Richard Giles from his Gadget Show podcast, which you can find at www.thepodcastnetwork.com/gadget. Richard talks to John Battelle about his history at Wired, his recent book on Google and search, and on a company that John is launching. Next week, we'll play an excerpt on John's new venture, but this week we have just enough time to play his answer to Richard's question about Google and evil.
The amount of research you've done and keeping an eye on Google, are they really not evil?
That's a tough motto to keep up with, I think, because it's inherently well-intentioned, but also inherently subjective. And so the more people that attempt to hold you to that standard, the more subjective standards there are. So, you know, what's evil in China versus what's evil in the United States is one big example. What's evil to owners of copyright and intellectual property versus what's evil to teenagers who have no money but want to share part of culture, right? The evil is very, very subjective, and so it's hard to hold that up as a model for your company, I think. It doesn't scale.
John Battelle with Richard Giles on The Gadget Show wraps up this pilot edition of Distributing the Future. Thanks to Richard for giving us permission to excerpt his program. Thanks also to our guests David Pogue, Nat Torkington, David Smith, Doc Searles, Andy Oram, Phil Terone, and Chris Adamson. We're betaing the show in public so that we can benefit from your comments, criticisms, and suggestions. If you have ideas to share with us, send email to future@O'Reilly.com. I'm Daniel Steinberg. Distributing the Future is a production of O'Reilly Media. Special thanks to David Bettino for composing and performing this theme music. Visit David's website at www.batmosphere.com. David also edits the O'Reilly Digital Audio site at digitalmedia.oreilly.com. This program was produced on Mac OS X Tiger using Soundtrack Pro, Audio Hijack Pro, and Skype.